Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Tuesday, March the 2nd. Today, we're going to be chatting with our good friend, Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. We're going to take a look at a couple of big issues this week. President Trump's speech on Tuesday night. We're going to look at the Democrats and their role as the opposition party. I can tell you before we get to Barry that I gave President Trump a pretty good grade on the speech. I think he probably, at least in my book, he got an A-, B+. I thought it was a good speech. Well prepared, well delivered. I thought he hit the right tone. As for the Democrats, I'm going to give them a little lower grade. I just I don't like opposition parties that have nothing to say except scream and protest or look for scandal. So I gave them a pretty low grade. We're also going to talk quickly about this Russian story out there that we'll get into it with Barry. But I'm very concerned again about the Democrats and why they're using stories like these to, rather than working with President Trump and trying to do something for their constituents, they seem to be clinging to all of these scandals and so on. It's not a very good situation for the country. Let me say hello to our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. How are you, Barry?
I'm fine. Good to speak with you.
Yes, the same here. We're not going to get into it too much tonight because exhibition season is not important, but roughly in another month or so, we'll have a lot of baseball to talk about. But there is something that I know you're very fond of, and that's a very important day in the month of March, a couple of days from now. Give us a quick rundown of that date, March the 4th. Tell me about that.
Well, actually, it's not that I'm especially fond of it. It's just that I've always noted it, and that is that 2 days from now, March 4th, is the only date in the entire calendar which is a command. And if you think about it, that's exactly what it is.
Right.
So anyway, right. So it's just a small thing, but just an interesting side note.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I'm so glad you mentioned it, because this is what makes the English language so unique, that you know, you have I can't think of the right term for it, but when two words are pronounced the same but they have a different meaning, like fourth,
it's called a homonym.
There you go. Yes. And I remember a few years ago I was teaching English as a second language for some students, and this is one of the things about English that really confuses the heck out of them, because as you know from your Spanish is phonetic. I mean, it's what you see is what you get. But in English, you have these, and it's really very interesting. Well, let's get into politics a little bit. I mentioned President Trump's speech, the Democrats. Why don't we begin with the Russian story? Because that hit the fan today, involving now Attorney General Sessions. I've spent not the whole day, because I don't really have time for it, but I've looked at that question that Senator Franken asked of the Attorney General. Well, at the time he was nominated for Attorney General, and I see the way he answered that question. Barry, I don't see what the big deal is. I really don't see what the big deal is. It was a hypothetical question. Yeah, the senator was asking a hypothetical question. If you know, something about a CNN story that allegedly CNN or the Russians had information on Trump. I mean, how long is this going to go on, Barry? I mean, it just seems outrageous to me. And the only people who can stop it, frankly, are the media.
Well, the media won't stop it. Actually, Silvio, this is not going to stop. This is the technique, the tactic that's being used. It's fake news. The whole Russian story is a fake story. There is nothing yet produced which shows anything that's improper about the contacts. And in fact, what we have improper is the fact that apparently the Obama administration and the former president himself deliberately set about to make this become a story after President Trump took office. The fact is, it's fake news. There's no evidence of any wrongdoing. For anyone who knows Washington, and I've never lived there as an adult, but I certainly have spent a lot of time there, is that the diplomatic community is constantly in contact with members of the government in a social manner, parties, receptions, meetings. It's commonplace. There's no question that, no one's denying, including Sessions, that he may have actually said hello to the Russian ambassador or maybe even exchanged a few polite words. There's no evidence of anything else. It's basically, here's the way it's done. So during the hearings for the confirmation, the Democrats couldn't stop the nominations. But what they could do is demand hearings for about 30 hours or whatever. And so they demanded and got that. And then, of course, Mr. McConnell shut off debate, and then almost all of the cabinet appointees have been confirmed, two more today. But in that 30 hours, they would bring up all the spurious allegations, things which are all fake news so far in most cases. And they would bring it up. And then after the confirmation, they bring it up later as a scandal. That's the strategy. That's all they got. They haven't got the votes. It's a technique. It's one way of being an opposition party. I think the Republicans have probably in the past done some things, if not the same, which are the equivalent. So I'm not saying the Democrats are the only ones who've ever done it. But the fact is, they're not being and you know, as you know, since you are a Republican, but I'm neither a Republican or Democrat, and I believe that we want to have a good opposition party. And the Democratic Party, as I have written, not only has the right to criticize, but the obligation to criticize. And all of that lies ahead. And the media, by the way, also is essentially a check on the various branches of the government, on both parties, by the way, not just one party. And they have not only the right, but the obligation to be critical. All of that is legitimate. But it's another thing when you have to manufacture the criticism, because you have no other technique or strategy in your mind, no imagination, on how to serve as an opposition party. And that's what's going on here. And they're going to do this again and again. It's not going away, Silvio. It's going to happen again. It's time for the Republican Party and the president to say, okay, you want to do that? Fine. The public isn't buying it. There's no question about that. And I think one of the things that has to happen here is we've got to stiffen up some of the Republican senators who seem to be super sensitive to any kind of criticism that goes on, and feel that they have to join in on the parade. The fact is, Republicans have the votes. You can't pull off that. The Republicans didn't do that for the most part. Maybe there were some individual instances, but the most part, they didn't do that in the last 8 years. Certainly not. And of course, they had the majority in many of those years, and were able to prevent unnecessary harassment of public officials. But this is a non-story. Now, that doesn't mean to say that the future. I'm not defending or saying that we have to be super friendly with Russia, but the fact is. That and by the way, the contact between members of Congress and members of an administration and ambassadors and other folks from foreign countries is so common. It's the whole thing is ludicrous, Silvio.
Right. No, I understand. And look, I am, as you know, we've done the show for a few years, and we have done, we've had conversations over the last couple of, a few years ago about Putin and how I thought Putin was getting away with a lot of things under President Obama. I've never been fond of Putin. I've always seen him as an opportunist, someone who will get away with whatever he can get away with. So I'm not, you know, I'm all for a tougher policy against Putin, which I never thought the administration or the Obama administration had. But when I look at where the public is, and this is where I think the Democrats are running into, are going to have a problem. And there's the polling data, as I indicated in my article at American Thinker, the polling data has it right now so that Democrats are there.
I'm here.
Oh, okay. There was just I thought we had lost communication there, but the polling data right now has it roughly 55% of Democrats. I'm talking members of the party, not the politicians. Basically, want their party to work with President Trump, and then you have a minority that want to fight. So Senator Schumer is sort of like stuck between these two. He has to satisfy the minority, because the minority are the ones who are sending him money or sending the party money. They're the ones who are organizing, whereas the larger majority, well, they're busy working. They're going on with their lives. But so I think this is the danger that the Democrats are really, or the problem they're going to have is that they're going to turn off the majority of the American people who think the election's over and they want to get these two parties to work together. And these two parties are not working together very right now, and I blame the Democrats for that.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that in terms of the early governing here, it's probably unrealistic to expect everybody to work together in some kind of kumbaya way. It's not going to happen. But and the Democrats have every right to be critical and to. But that doesn't mean to say that when you lack a majority of the votes, that you try and act in an irresponsible fashion and create use fake news or create stumbling blocks for things getting done. Now, in the last few days, we've had almost all the remaining cabinet officers approved. To be fair to the Democrats, although they've really held up the cabinet officers, Mr. Trump has not made a lot of appointments yet. He's got deputy secretaries, and he's got ambassadors, and he's got a whole bunch of judges, 130 federal judges, all need to be confirmed and even nominated. So, but if the Democrats are going to do this all the time, I think, as you made the point, the public's going to get very tired of it very quickly. The public does not want the government to be a stalemate and come to a standstill, especially when you don't have – I mean, if the Democrats had a majority, that would be a different story. But they don't, and they certainly don't have a majority in the House, and they certainly don't have the majority in the Senate. And coming back to when we opened the program, I think you understated the grade. I gave Trump a better grade. I gave him a solid A. I didn't give him an A+ because you can always do better, and it wasn't a perfect speech, but it was one of the really – it was a turning point speech, and it really caught the Democrats and the never-Trumpers off guard. Because he acted not only very presidential, but it was quite a performance. He stayed on script. He had a script. He didn't try and make things up on going along the way, which is a trap for him. And it was a thoughtful, serious speech. As you point out, and I completely agree with you, I would give the Democrats a D minus because I guess you can the idea that the women wore white as a protest, that's not the most serious thing in the world. You can say that that wasn't totally appropriate. I don't know. I'm not going to be overly harsh here. But to sit down and fail to applaud when a Navy SEAL hero is being honored, or to basically pretend that they're, you know, just have be cold. Even I remember that during Obama's years, there were times when the Republicans sat quietly and didn't applaud.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even that one case when Congressman Wilson said, "You lie," and that was inappropriate.
Right.
It was inappropriate.
Totally.
I don't praise it.
No.
But for the most part, they applauded. And many during when the President Obama walked in, a lot of Republicans went over and shook his hand. And I mean, there is a kind of decorum which one expects at that level, and a courtesy. And screaming is perfectly. I mean, the Democrats, they had an opportunity for the rebuttal, and they put up this rather inept former governor of Kentucky that he even called himself a Republican by mistake.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
He's a former governor and really.
Right.
So I mean, it was. I mean, they had a proper area where they could have had one of their most articulate persons make a rebuttal, but no, they had to behave badly, and it didn't impress the country.
It was a very bad night for the Democrats.
It made that solid core of Democrats happy, but you know what?
Yeah, it was
those
a
people,
very it was a very
those people are not
going to
change
the
anything.
The
margin is in the middle. The independents,
the
moderate Democrats, the moderate Republicans, who are looking for action, for activity, for performance. They're not into just rhetoric, and they're certainly not into just empty gestures. And what we saw there was empty gestures. That, in fact, as you want, you made, you're completely right. This thing is backfiring. Their numbers are, it's kind of like what's happening with the media. CNN
mm-hmm.
is going to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when are their
That's
executives
right.
going to face up to the fact that their strategy for distorting the news is backfiring enormously?
Well, and in the case of the Democrats, I mean, you basically have a situation where they're in such bad shape. I mean, the focus is always on the federal politics, because, I mean, that is the national politics. So we talk about the presidency, the House, and the Senate. But where the Democrats are in deep trouble, and I thought maybe this is why they selected a former governor of Kentucky, but they're in deep trouble in places like Kentucky. And they're in deep trouble. And they it's like a, if I could use a baseball analogy, it's like the baseball team that has just nobody in the farm system. And when you're in a situation like that, what you got to do is you got to start working from the bottom up, and you got to start, you know, drafting people and getting people ready to run. And I don't see how anything that the Democrats are doing in Washington, D.C. this week is helping them at all in rebuilding the party, which is where they need to be. Let me take a quick break, Barry. We're going to hear from my friend Carlos Geddes. And then when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Barry Kosselman, the Prairie Editor.
This is Carlos Geddes, Harpist, and I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Nola Brasserie Authentic Cajun and Creole Restaurant, located at 1201 Main Street, downtown Dallas. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy jazz at 7:30 until midnight. So make your reservation today at 469-872-1820.
You know, we went to see Carlos a couple of weeks ago, and he was absolutely fantastic. The food is very good. The music is very good. So if you're in the Dallas area or you're traveling by or on business or whatever, and you're here Saturday night, especially if you're in the downtown area, it's just a great night. It's just a great night. Everything is very reasonable, very good. And you get to see my friend Carlos play some of that harp, which is absolutely fantastic. Let's get back to our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. Barry, before we let me begin this segment quickly talking about something that kind of ties into the Democrats a little bit, and that is, and I hope to, I think on Friday morning my post will be available. I have a post about Valerie Jarrett moving in with the Obamas in their house in Washington, and I guess the strategy is that they're going to try to, you know, put the old band together, as they say, put the band together and try to bring down the Trump administration. And I make the point in the article, Barry, that they may try to do that, but as long as the Republicans, and this is where why I thought the Trump speech was good, as long as the Republicans really stick to their strategy and keep their promises and do the best they can by keeping promises and staying together, it doesn't really matter what the Democrats do. The Democrats can try to bring down Trump if they want to, but if the Republicans stick together and fulfill their promises, I think they can pull this off, Barry.
Well, I don't think there's any question. I think there's a big danger for Democrats in only less than 2 years. Only next year are the midterm elections, and they've got twice as many, more than twice as many Senate seats up for election than the Republicans do, a reverse of 2016, and their prospects in the House, I mean, I saw today Stanley Hoyer said they could pick up to 35 seats. Well, you can name any number you want. The fact is that I suppose anything is possible, but barring the unforeseen, the chances of them picking up 35 seats is almost close to nil. And in fact, there's even a scenario, should they continue to behave in the way they're doing now, where they would actually lose, in spite of the fact that they're way behind to begin with, they could actually lose a net amount of seats in the House. And they're certainly going to lose, almost certainly going to lose seats in the Senate. Question is how many, and if it's enough, they would no longer even have the 40 seats available with which to block legislation, some legislation, and they would be a shadow party, a ghost of a party. So the Democrats have a lot at stake here, and I think the smarter ones, I think there are many thoughtful Democrats, and some that are really more to my center views like Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp, but there are many others who are reasonable. They're liberals, and they sincerely believe in their philosophy, and it's a totally legitimate philosophy, whether you agree with it or not. And I think they want what we're talking about here is being successful, not just blowing off steam. I mean, the Democrats, I think, did a dodged a bullet when they chose Mr. Perez for their party chair, because I think our own Keith Ellison up here in Minnesota would have been a net negative for them. People up here were rooting for him because he would have had to resign as member of Congress, and a lot of people, conservatives anyway, who wanted him to him not to be. Nevertheless, he was in his remarks trying to be elected. He said it was time to impeach the president. The guy's only been in office a month. Hasn't really done anything one way or the other.
Right.
That's impeachable anyway. In fact, what he's, I mean, you and I probably agree with most of the things what he has done. That doesn't make it right, he's changing Washington and changing the whole system of the establishment system of government. But the fact is, the Democrats have to think about what they're going to do to appeal to beyond their base. They've got 25 to 30% of the votes, absolutely solid. And that's their solid base and their left base. And then they've got another 15 or 20% that usually vote Democrat but can be changed, as they were, in some of them in 2016, those who voted for Trump. And then there's a whole bunch of people right in the middle, which are neither Republican or Democrat. And, you know, if they can't appeal to those people, what's their chance? Their chance is zero. They're going to lose seats, not gain seats.
That's right. Let me bring up a couple of points. Go ahead and finish.
I was just going to say that a midterm election, historically, almost every midterm election president in his first term loses seats. Now, there's been a few exceptions, but they usually lose seats. And people were certainly believing that, since they thought Trump couldn't possibly succeed, that he'll lose seats in 2 years because they think he'll be such a failure. But that's not the way it's working out. He's starting to show that he might have some success. And in any event, since they have many more seats up and more vulnerable seats up, they have a big risk here. And if they don't get sensible pretty soon, I mean, we forget that the 2018 campaign has already begun. Now, it's begun modestly. In the next couple of months, it's going to get even more, because in order to run for Congress or the U.S. Senate, you really need, if you're a challenger, particularly, if you're a challenger, you need at least a year and a half, maybe 2 years, advance to raise money, get organized, put your campaign together, and especially raise money. And especially these days, because in both parties, when there's challengers, there are primaries. And so you not only have to win the nomination, you not only have to run against the incumbent, you have to win the nomination. So the campaigns are beginning. And by the way, by the time midsummer comes along, they'll be outgoing full force.
That's right.
I mean,
it takes a lot of money. It also takes a lot of money to run if you're a challenger, and it takes time to put it together. But let me just make a couple of quick points about the Democrats that I wanted to jump in here and get your reaction. The first one is, you mentioned impeachment. I was talking with a friend of mine in South America, and he said to me, "Is that possible that Trump could be impeached?" And I said, "Well, first of all, there has to be a crime." I mean, impeachment is not like just, you know, resignation, as happens sometimes in other countries, you know. I explained to my friend the process. You have to go to the House, the Senate, and so on. So I said, no, there's no chance, because the Republicans control the House, so it would have to get out of the House. And if it ever got to the point, and I explained this to my friend, if it ever got to the point that the Republicans thought that he would be impeached, or that he did something bad enough to be impeached, they would get him to resign. They wouldn't put it through an impeachment, as happened with Nixon in 74. So calls for impeachment are completely silly on the part of these Democrats, but I know that's part of the way they keep their base happy. The other point that I wanted to make, go back to something you said a minute ago, and that is the Democrats moving forward. I have got to believe that there are people like you said, Manchin and some of the others, who are just as desperate, I suppose, as we are, but why aren't they speaking out? I mean, Manchin, he's not going to lose in West Virginia. He's going to probably get reelected because he's a very popular senator there, very popular political figure. Why aren't they standing up and telling Chuck Schumer, "Chuck, you got to cut this out. This is crazy. This is suicidal." Or even coming out in public and making these statements, Barry, why aren't the Democrats, the good Democrats, standing up and saying, "You guys are driving us into the ditch, and we're already in a, you know, we're already in the ditch, but you're going to dig us deeper, Barry"?
Well, first of all, Manchin has. Remember, he was the one senator who, on two or three occasions, was the only Republican who voted for confirmation of of a Trump cabinet officer. He would refuse to be bullied. And then the other thing was, when President Trump spoke out in favor of the coal miners, Mr. Manchin was the only one of the, if not the only, certainly one of the few Democrats who stood up and applauded. He didn't have much choice, of course. His election is not guaranteed. The problem for him is he's very popular, and but you know, West Virginia is now a Republican state, solid, and even more so now that Trump is championing the coal miners. Same thing is true, by the way, in western Pennsylvania and southeastern Ohio, which are also, and some parts of Kentucky, which are also mining areas. And Heidi Heitkamp is running in a state that's overwhelmingly Republican. She won last time because her opponent was a weak candidate. Sometimes, I wrote a piece not so long ago saying that the candidates still matter. Republicans, when they put up weak candidates, deserve to lose, even though right. they're favored to win. Because
that's
you know,
what happened
it's
in Missouri. Remember, in Missouri in 2012, Indiana as well. I mean, those were two seats. I remember
Delaware.
Talking about this, about those two seats in Missouri and Indiana were literally given away by the Republicans, in my opinion.
And then on the contrary, because the Republicans recruited so many excellent candidates in 2014 and 18, they did very well. In fact, in 2014, they won 9 out of 9. I mean, it was really amazing. Because they had good candidates. And neither or Manchin is assured of a winning. But on the other hand, the Democrats have a problem. If they give Joe Manchin or Heidi Heitkamp too much of a problem, remember, they're in the minority. So when you're in Congress, a little less so in the Senate, but even in the Senate, if you're in the minority, you're on committees, but you're not a chairman. You have nothing to say, really. You have very little to say, usually, unless you're willing to cooperate. And no one seems to be willing to do that these days. Here's what would happen. In Manchin's case and Heitkamp's case, they'd switch parties. Remember, that's what Pat Leahy did. He was a Republican. He changed to a Democrat. And then he got a chairmanship. And he was a solid vote for the Democrats, and Democrats want to give their moderates like Manchin and Heitkamp a hard time, they might wake up and find that they're no longer Democrats. Instead of 52, it's 54 Republicans.
No, that's true.
And that's
the
problem.
Exactly right. I also. No, I also read today, Barry, very quickly, and then I want to get to one quick story. But I also read today that there is a very serious movement in the Democrat Party. Bernie Sanders has an organization behind it where they're going to challenge some of these senators, like Mr. Manchin and some of these others. They're going to challenge them in the primary for working with President Trump. So that would be an even bigger reason for somebody like Joe Manchin to say, hey, I'll switch parties, and I definitely will get reelected if I switch parties. It's a shame
Heitkamp and Manchin, then they will definitely lose because those states are overwhelmingly Republican.
Exactly, but it's a shame that it's come to that because the Democrat Party should be more intelligent than that, Barry.
Well, remember, let's be fair. Some Republicans on the right in past years did the same thing to the Republican Party. They challenged incumbents
right.
who weren't pure enough. Both sides, when you get on the extreme wings of each party, they say things like, we don't want to govern. We just want to have our way. And so, to be fair, when the Democrats do this, we have to recall the Republicans did it too, and did it quite a bit.
Right, they did it to the senator from Idaho, was it? The senator from Idaho? Or in the last election, they did it either to the senator from Idaho or
I think it was
one of the Western Montana, one of the Western senators, yeah, who they challenged him in the primary. You remember what happened to Representative Cantor back in 2014. He was challenged in the primaries as well in
or
Virginia
Richard
for his
Richard
Lugar, yeah.
In
so
Indiana.
So these things, you're right, they can happen on both sides. It just so happens right now that it appears to be happening on the left. Let me, before we go, I just wanted to take a quick second, Barry, and change directions for just a couple of minutes here, because yesterday would have been the day or the anniversary of Mickey Mantle retiring from baseball in 1969. You and I are big baseball fans. You probably remember Mickey Mantle a lot more than I do, but I'm sure he was a huge fan when you were growing up. And any you know, when you think of an anniversary of Mickey Mantle, does anything come to your mind?
Well, I mean, he was my favorite player growing up. He was I actually, in my very first game that I saw in Cleveland's Municipal Stadium in 1949, I actually saw his predecessor, Joe DiMaggio. But the next time I went, the next year when I went to because we went every year from Erie to Cleveland to see a game, and my father and my brother were close Cleveland Indians fans. I was a Yankee fan. So the way we solved that was we went during a Yankee-Indian game. And I saw Mantle and Berra and Scovran and all the great Yankees of that era and subsequent year era. And Mantle was one of the greats. He was an incredible he was incredibly fast in spite of his bad knees. He was an incredible outfielder, a great hitter. He hit for a high average, not just home runs. And he was a personality. Now, he had some problems, personal problems, and he had to retire early because he had osteomyelitis, I think is the name of it, the weakening of the knees. Otherwise, he would have even had even more. I mean, I think he hit 535 home runs, but he would have hit more if he'd been in baseball longer. And
well, he had 536. That was his final total. 536. But when you consider that, you know, he probably could have. I mean, had he had good knees and in an optimum situation, he probably would have been able to maybe play in another 500, 600 games in his career. So you're looking at probably another 150 home runs. So it's very possible that he would have hit, if not 700, he would have been, you know, maybe 660, 670. So it would have made it very interesting. He would have been, I think, in my opinion, he would have been the first player to seriously challenge Ruth, not the season record, but the career record. I think he could have done that with good knees, but, you know, it was the way it was.
He still
had
51
home
runs in one year.
That's
in fact, he hit 51 the year. I actually saw Mantle and Maris play that year at a Indian-Yankee doubleheader in Metropolitan Stadium when they hit back-to-back home runs in the first inning.
Yeah, they were absolutely awesome, the two of them. But Mantle, you know, Mantle was a three-time MVP. He hit 56 home runs, I believe, one year when he won the Triple Crown as well. I never saw him play other than a little bit on television. But that was, again, at the end of his career. And he was even playing first base, I think, at the time for the Yankees. But a great trivia question about Mickey Mantle is he hit number 500 on Mother's Day in May of 1967. I read that in his biography. Well, Barry, as always, thank you so much for your time. We'll do it again. We'll keep up with the politics and talk a little baseball now as the season is coming. So thank you. Great work that you always do at the Prairie Editor. And thank you for keeping me and so many of your readers informed the way that you do, Barry.
Well, it's my pleasure to appear on your program. I always enjoy it.
Thank you so much. And have a wonderful evening. I bet it's a little warm in Minnesota tonight, right?
No, actually, it's a cool. We're incredibly seasonably warm winter. We're going to be in the 60s. You understand, the average temperature, the average high in Minnesota at this time of year is 28, and the average low is about 10. And yet we've been routinely in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and then in a 2 or 3 days, we're going to be in the 60s. So that's 30 degrees above normal. But it's been this way
wow.
virtually all winter, with occasional little Arctic blasts that take us down to cold weather. But, you know, we're used to very cold weather. And we're having a, I mean, there's hardly any snow on the ground. There hasn't been any for weeks. So I'm not so sure we mind global warming.
No, I having lived up in Wisconsin, I think global warming is actually a pretty good thing. To have at least a month of global warming in winter up in that part is always a lot of fun. Have a wonderful evening, Barry, and thank you so much for your time.
Good night.
All right, good night. Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor, always a good friend of our show. We love chatting with him. And tonight we got into a little bit of the politics. Always enjoy what Barry has to say. Check out his website, the Prairie Editor. We have a link to it on the show information, and if you can subscribe to it, I think you'll find his commentary to be outstanding. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.